Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener supported KGNU. Coming up on today's Morning Magazine, this week, the first people in the US got counted as part of the 2020 census. This happened in Alaska, but right here in Colorado, local groups are gearing up for the count that'll happen in the spring. They're reaching out to the community, particularly communities that have been underrepresented in the past, and they're working to ensure that everyone gets counted. We'll hear from a member of the Boulder County Complete Count Committee. Then, you know those ozone alerts that are often issued by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment? In fact, one was issued yesterday. Well, people in the sensitive categories are advised to limit outdoor activity and be aware of poor air quality. Well, we'll hear what it's like to be one of those people who is directly impacted when those ozone alerts are issued. This is a story that's part of The Brink, a radio series produced by students in CU's Environmental Studies program in collaboration with KGNU and the Just Transition Collaborative. After that, we'll hear from a local group that's organising an event this Saturday. It's part of a global day of action to raise awareness about the 5G technology rollout. Then Leland Drucker fills us in on the latest cannabis news before we go back to the BBC for headlines. Then just after 8:30, a special edition of Radio Nibbles to kick off a year of coverage that KGNU will be doing on food waste. John Lendorf will join us live in the studio with a local chef teaching us some knife skills and food preparation techniques that will help us reduce waste in the kitchen. Then at 9 o'clock, Tish Buford speaks with La Cochina. That's a non-profit organisation that provides mental health and health equity services for the Latinx Spanish-speaking population of northern Colorado. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Lawmakers at the State House are looking to tackle the high cost of prescription drugs with some new bills that have been introduced. The Denver Post reports that thus far three bills have been introduced this session with a view to controlling drug prices that have been rising faster than inflation for several years. A state report showed that about 11% of Colorado residents didn't fill a prescription last year because of the cost of the drugs. Two of the bills that have been introduced would create more transparency in how pharmaceutical companies price drugs. House Bill 1160 would require notification from manufacturers when prices increase, and they would require drug companies to provide explanations for increases over 10% over a 12-month period. Senate Bill 107 would require prescription drug manufacturers to report drug production cost data to the Department of Healthcare Policy and Financing, which provides an annual drug price transparency report to legislative committees. And a third bill would ban pharmacy benefit managers from requesting retroactive fees after prescriptions have already been filled. Work at the state legislature this week attracted the attention of Elizabeth Warren, one of the candidates in the Democratic presidential primary. Colorado Politics reports that on Wednesday afternoon, Senator Warren tweeted her approval for a piece of legislation that's been introduced that would give state employees in Colorado collective bargaining rights. Senator Warren tweeted that the bill is a huge step forward, adding that state employees work hard and support Colorado families and that they deserve the same in return. House Bill 1153 is also known as the Partnership for Quality Jobs and Services Act, and it was introduced by Representative Danaya Esgar, a Democrat from Pueblo. It includes provisions for union organizing with new employees and payroll deduction for dues for state employees. Colorado College announced yesterday that it had achieved carbon neutrality. The Denver Post reports that this is the first higher education institution in the Rocky Mountain region and one of only a handful in the nation to achieve carbon neutrality by 2020. The private college in Colorado Springs has been working for more than 10 years to reach the goal. Emissions at the school are down 75% from 2008. However, the college still has some emissions, including from vehicles and college-related air travel. However, it says it can claim to be carbon neutral when it factors in on-campus reductions and off-campus projects that reduce or eliminate greenhouse gases elsewhere. In the weather today, expect mostly sunny skies around the Front Range, highs in the mid-40s. 40s, slightly breezy conditions though. And tomorrow, similar temperatures, maybe a little bit warmer, getting closer to 50 in the low 50s for Saturday and Sunday. And there's a slight chance of some rain coming in on Monday. It is 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU. This week, the first people in the country were counted as part of the 2020 census. The count in Colorado will happen in the spring, but local groups are already organising to get the word out to have full participation in the census. KGNU's equity reporter, Rosanna Longo, spoke with Peggy Leach, who's with the League of Women Voters and who is a member of the Boulder County Complete Count Committee.
So the census is always important. You know, it's mandated by the, well, I mean, it's spelled out in the Constitution that we're supposed to do this every 10 years. The original reason in the Constitution was to determine representation from the states to the House of Representatives. So it determines how many representatives each state will get based on population. So Colorado currently has 7 representatives to Congress. It's widely expected that our population has grown enough to where we'll have 8 representatives. So we want to get everybody counted. That representation also extends out to the within the state. In our state legislature, we've got different districts for the House and for the Senate. That's all based on population. So within Colorado, we'll probably be drawing some new districts. And so there'll be some different representation in the state legislature based on the count. So that's all the political thing. Then it's become a way of Congress and the federal government dispersing funds to the states and to the cities based on population. So various programs that they do are dispersed to the states based on the population. So the more people that are counted, the more resources the states receive. These are things like SNAP, Medicare, transportation dollars, funds for helping aging people, just different programs are based on population. It's been estimated that the amount of aid that comes to Colorado is somewhere between $1,500 and $2,300 per year per person that was counted. So if there's one person that's not counted, we're missing out on approximately $2,000 from the federal government, and that happens for the next 10 years until the next census. So that's really $20,000 per person that Colorado and the county does not receive for people that are not counted.
That's a big amount.
Yes, yes. So it has a big impact. A lot of the goal of the whole countywide group, is to get as many people counted, self-counted as possible, so that the census workers don't need to be going out and knocking on doors afterwards, trying to get other people that didn't respond. For one thing, that's scary to the people that would have people knocking on their doors. And for another, it's just a more expensive way of having to send people out. And you know, they may not be home, they may not answer the door, all those kinds of things. So it's much easier if we can get people to respond themselves.
This time around, this 2020 census, there is something that is different from the 2010 census. It's going to represent another set of problems for a community that is already difficult to count.
Yes, so for the first time, there will be an online response. And they do recognize that that's a problem for like rural areas that don't have good internet access. Also a problem for older people that are not good at technology. And also a problem for lower income and, you know, people that just don't have the technology. So there are other ways to respond, you know, so online is the preferred method. There's also a written form that can be filled out and mailed in. There's also calling in, and then the final would be, if none of those three work, then they'll send out in-person people to try and find your information. One of the other issues about that is that a lot of people feel like that is not secure. And of course, they're working as hard as they can to make sure that it's safe from attacks and cyber attacks and all that type of thing. And, you know, even by turning in a written form and then putting all that into the census data, you know, that's just as hackable if it were to be hacked. So, you know, they're working as hard as they can with the most, you know, the resources of the federal government that's trying to keep everything from being hacked, military secrets and all that kind of thing. They're trying to keep this very safe and secure, too.
Peggy Leach is with the Boulder County Complete Count Committee. Now, they're working to try to reach the hard-to-count populations to encourage full participation in the census count that's going to be happening in Colorado this spring. Well, tune in next Thursday morning at 8:30 for another episode in our new series, Trends. It's a collaboration with the Community Foundation of Boulder County, and we're going to take a deep dive into the efforts that people are making to have everyone counted in the county. But we're also going to hear from communities who are fearful of participating in the census. So we'll delve into that further. That is coming up next Thursday morning, just after 8:30. Well, The Brink is a radio storytelling project about what is needed to transition to a more just environment and society. It tells stories of inequality, struggle and transformation. And it's a collaboration between the Environmental Studies Programme at CU Boulder in partnership with KGNU and the Just Transition Collaborative. Well, this morning we'll hear about the impact of high ozone levels on residents in the metro area in this report produced by Jamie Lee.
Today we are looking at how ground-level ozone affects the residents in the Denver metro area.
Denver now ranks 12th worst in the country among cities for ozone pollution, and that is down from our ranking last year, or worse than our ranking last year, where we were number 14. Some days you can see that brown cloud hanging over the metro area. That is ozone pollution, or smog. And in the past year, Denver experienced more unhealthy days of high ozone, which is very dangerous to breathe. For those with compromised lungs, you're going to want to pay close attention to the air quality alert days that come out from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and be sure to stay inside or limit your outdoor activity on those days.
These news reports have a real impact on people living in the Denver metro area, like Bella Lopez, a 21-year-old resident who was born and raised here.
It's early on a Monday morning. After getting dressed, I checked the weather on my phone and noticed the air quality is marked unhealthy for sensitive groups. This alert gives me an idea of how my day will be. On days like this one, I know not to be outside for long periods of time and to pre-treat with my inhaler along with all of my other daily medicine. I work at an elementary school, so I let my boss know that I can't be outside to monitor recess or participate in the walk to the park due to the air quality today.
Well, ozone is a really fascinating pollutant to study from a scientific perspective because it's not emitted directly. It forms in the atmosphere. And so it takes reactions of nitrogen oxides and volatile organic compounds to mix together. And the sunlight basically cooks and processes that chemical mix and leads to the formation of ozone.
That's Jana Milford. She's a professor in the Mechanical Engineering Department at the University of Colorado Boulder. She also specializes in research regarding the formation of air pollutants in the Denver metro area and how to reduce their potency.
It relates to human health effects because ultimately what we're trying to do is describe how much ozone is produced and what levels people are exposed to and then what consequences that has for them and for their health.
How exactly does ground level ozone affect people? Well, ozone is a lung irritant, making it especially dangerous for those in the sensitive group.
So sensitive groups are people who have pre-existing respiratory conditions. So people who have asthma already would be included in that. Elderly people are often considered to be sensitive, but again, especially if they've got some sort of pre-existing respiratory condition, respiratory infection, or some sort of chronic respiratory disease, that would be a concern.
So I do have scar tissue on my lungs. So they call that chronic lung disease. We treat it like it's asthma, but it's a lot more severe. So I was born with it. I was born 10 weeks premature. So being born 10 weeks premature, you know, everything isn't completely developed.
Bella has been struggling with Denver's poor air quality her entire life.
If I go outside or I'm out doing things, I notice that it's my chest is a little more tight than usual. So I definitely have to, like, do my inhaler a few times a day just to make sure that I'm staying open and I can, like, breathe properly. I take Dulera, which is a bronchial dilator, so it just keeps me open throughout the day just so that I can breathe better. And then I also have an emergency inhaler, which is just albuterol, which is like, you know, an extra shot of bronchial dilation. Definitely helps in emergencies. And then I also take two allergy pills. So it's Singulair and Zyrtec.
Remember that Denver 7 news report for those with compromised lungs? Well, for Bella, those alerts mean she'll have a hard time breathing today.
Yeah, I've noticed that it definitely takes a toll on me a lot more than, you know, it usually would. Like I said, there are days where I'm like, I would go out, I wake up, I go out, and it's just like a lot harder for me to breathe and do like even like walking. Like, let's say I go downtown 16th Street Mall, like walking from store to store and just kind of hanging out in certain areas, it definitely affects me a lot more.
Professor Milford says Denver has been struggling to meet the federal air quality standards for ozone for quite a while.
Part of the challenge is that as our understanding of the health effects improves, the standards themselves get tighter because we are recognizing that health effects occur at lower levels of ozone pollution than we might have understood previously. But it's a challenging problem because it's a complicated mix of sources, and we feel like we get a handle on one source and maybe get emissions from that reduced, and then other sources crop up. And of course, in Denver, in the whole Front Range region, we've got population that's increasing, more and more vehicles all of the time. Oil and gas activity has been increasing over the years. And so it just has proven really difficult to, I would say, stay on top of the problem, to kind of get ahead of it, which is what we really need to do.
Some common sources that contribute to the formation of ground-level ozone include burning of coal, oil, or gas in motor vehicles and power plants. With the increasing population across Colorado's Front Range, it is likely that we will continue to experience unhealthy air quality unless necessary action is taken. For KGNU and The Brink, this is Janie Lee.
And tomorrow morning, we'll hear more from The Brink, series that is being produced by students in the Environmental Studies program at CU Boulder. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at climate education in schools. It is 8:21. You're listening to KGNU. Well, 5G or fifth generation technology is getting rolled out around the country and indeed around the world. And there are a lot of people who are raising their voice with some concerns. Some people say there are potential security risks. Other people say they're concerned that local control is being taken away from communities and how all of this is getting rolled out. Now, others say that the FCC, that's the Federal Communication Commission, is fast tracking the rollout of this technology without adequately looking at the possible health implications. And many others, though, say, well, this is actually safe technology. Well, this Saturday, there's a global day of protest about the 5G rollout, and an event is scheduled to take place at the Boulder Public Library that will explore many of these concerns. I spoke with one of the organisers, Doe Kelly, who's with the group Coloradans for Safe Technology.
There's quite a number of things in particular, and I will speak personally for myself as a person who has some element of electrosensitivity and who has been involved in the arena of spirituality and energy work, that there are health concerns from fifth-generation wireless. The research that is being done by certain really quite eminent scientists in this country and abroad shows that even before we get to 5G, which incorporates the 4G and the 3G underneath it, that there are legitimate problems with wireless technology, health issues in particular. And with the fifth generation wireless, the idea is to bring in a whole new spectrum of higher frequencies than what we're already operating on right now in the 4G and the 3G, which also obviously stand for fourth generation and third generation wireless technology. In the 5G arena, the thought is that in order to drive things like artificial intelligence, driverless automobiles, let's see, there's a few other things there, and I'm not sure that I can name all of them, but I know those are two of them right there, that we have to have these millimeter waves, which are in the range of the frequency spectrum above where we're sitting right now, with our wireless devices, which is usually, from what I can tell, in about the range of a 2.5 gigahertz or 5 gigahertz speedway, so to speak. And when you get above 6 gigahertz, going up to around 30, my understanding is that is really sub-millimeter wave. When you get above 30 going up to 300, you're in the millimeter wave range on the electromagnetic spectrum. And it's an untested arena in terms of using these bandwave frequencies to broadcast information, using that as carrier waves. We're already using microwaves as carrier waves, and the science is finding that we're having health problems. So we have issues with this, and we think that, and we and many, many, many people around the world, including scientists and doctors, medical professionals, and really a lot of intelligent people, and that goes across the board to people from all professions, are looking at this and saying, not so fast. Yes.
There have been a lot of people, and scientists as well, who have said, actually, the concerns about 5G have been overblown. But from what I'm hearing is that a lot of the concern is the fact that there isn't necessarily a huge body of research, because it doesn't seem that there have been very detailed research done into the potential impacts of 5G. So from hearing about this global protest that's happening, it seems that it's the lack of transparency maybe about what is known, but really the uncertainty about what isn't known, that's driving a lot of people to be concerned about this, because it is getting rolled out quite fast. You mentioned the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. They're in many ways fast-tracking the rollout of 5G. That's along with this effort to provide internet access really to more people around the country. And so is it really the uncertainty and the lack of knowledge that you think people are concerned about?
I absolutely think that is true, and I think that there are people within our government who know this, and I believe is it Senator Blumenthal or Representative Blumenthal, whichever he is, held a hearing with people from the top of the telecoms in last March, and he asked them point blank, are there any studies, any research, have you allocated any funds for this? And they all said, no, we haven't, to do the studies on this before they roll it out. So basically, they're rolling something out before it's tested, before it's proven. And in the wake of that, we know that the earlier generations of wireless devices are showing problems, not only for human life, but for insect and potentially plant life on this planet. And so there is a great outcry. And there's also a piece of this puzzle that goes looking into space, that SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, is also green-lighted by the FCC to put as many as, now, and this may be a total, may be inclusive of a couple of other companies, but Musk's has got the green light to put tens of thousands of satellites in low Earth orbit around the planet, in what's called a Starlink. And they're being put up there to support the 5G infrastructure on Earth. And there's now a large outcry coming from the astronomers on this planet who are saying, wait a minute, now just imagine as many as 50,000 satellites in low Earth orbit. We've got maybe in the 2000 range up there right now. Imagine this, people trying to look through their telescopes to look at that, you know, dim star over there, that planet over there, and you've got 50,000 satellites. Now, I can't say to exactly how large they are, but to me, it's a no-brainer. Nobody asked me, do you want to be able to see your night sky anymore or not? To me, of course I want to see the night sky. And, oh boy, what a thrill once in a while the space station goes over and we hear of it, we can go out and watch it. But I want to be able to see those meteor showers. And I'm not a scientist, but the scientists want to be able to carry out their research. And the weather scientists, including NOAA, want to be able to carry out whatever things that they do in order to forecast the weather with their satellites. And they're up in an outcry about this because they're afraid that there's going to be overlap in the frequency ranges having to do with water vapor and clouds from what's going to be broadcast from this network of up to 50,000 satellites in low Earth orbit. And so to my mind, that's totally unacceptable.
That's Jo Kelly. She's with Coloradans for Safe Technology. That's a group that's organising an event happening on Saturday as part of a global day of action around 5G. It's at the Boulder Public Library, the downtown branch, and it's from 4 to 6pm. It's in the Arapaho Room. There'll be a lot of people involved in various different aspects of this. We'll be talking, a screening of a documentary and more. And you can find out more if you email coemfalliance@gmail.com, and that stands for Coloradans for coemfalliance@gmail.com, or go to the website stop5ginternational.org. It's 8:30. You're listening to KGNU. Leland Rucker is a senior editor at Sensi Magazine. He joins us Thursday mornings to talk about the latest news in cannabis. Today we're going to take a look at a report and then the subsequent media coverage of the report that took a look at the implications of marijuana use and driving. First of all, tell us about the report. This came out of Harvard University.
Yeah, it was a, if you're watching cannabis news, it's hard to, it was hard to miss coverage last week of this study. It's from Harvard University. And it's from the Neuroscientific Discovery Program, which is called the MIND Mind Program. And it was aimed to explore in a preliminary way whether heavy cannabis users who begin using the plant earlier in life display poorer driving habits than people who started later on. And it didn't really find any of those things, but, you know, for instance, the headline on NBC News was, "Even when sober, frequent marijuana users are dangerous drivers." Fox News said, "Weed impairs driving skills long after the high is gone, new study shows." And basically, the study didn't find any of those things. This is something that's been going on for a long time. Scientific study is a slow process. Media outlets should treat it that way, but basically media outlets don't. If you only read certain news articles, the potentially misleading title and the top points of the study, which is what even I think some reporters use rather than studying, looking at the entire study, that's easy to miss. And in this particular study, 44 people were involved. 28 they identified as heavy users and 16 as healthy control participants. And they tested their driving in simulators, complete with fake chair, fake wheel, pedals, a 19-inch monitor showing a simulated roadway, not in actual driving conditions. And results showed that heavy cannabis users were slightly more likely than healthy controls to miss stop signs, speed, or hit the animated pedestrians. Most other driving metrics were about the same between groups. But again, if you saw that in the media over the last week, you would have gotten these other headlines that really don't say what the study. In fact, the people who did the study finally had to tell the Boston Globe that to caution that they don't prove heavy early users are functionally impaired behind the wheel on roads. They're just seeing relatively poor performance in early users compared to non-using controls. So this was a thing that was intended to be a preliminary study, but the headlines would tell you that this is already proven fact.
I mean, this also shows that there really aren't that many studies out there. We've talked a lot about this, the lack of research for all of medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, its health implications, you know, all of this. And so we are seeing some of these studies emerge, but it does seem that sometimes mainstream media can hop on those studies and blow them up, even if they are preliminary studies like the researchers in this actually cautioned the media about.
You know, the media are looking for clickbait right now, and that means putting headlines up there that say things that are probably not really in the story. When I grew up as a reporter, we were told the headline says exactly what's in the story and not anything more. That isn't the case anymore. You know, with social media, clickbait getting people to like things is the way things go. I just caution that maybe that's not the best way to keep doing it.
People can read more about that and other news about cannabis online at ncmag.com. And of course, catch Leland Rucker here on KGNU on Thursday mornings. Thanks, Leland.